Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 213, The Highly Sensitive Person, with Dr. Ted Zeff. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
One thing that's so important is because so many sensitive people growing up were told they were bad and wrong, it's easy to get a victim consciousness. And, I mean, I'll never forget this lady who called me, and she was so upset because she was living in New York City, and the people upstairs from her were making so much noise it was giving her a nervous breakdown, and she quit her job. I said, well, why don't you move? And she said, oh, I can't move. It's a rent-controlled building, and I like this neighborhood. So I see that kind of sometimes, that tendency to be a victim because they were told they were bad and flawed. And it's so important for me in my role as a counselor to really empower the highly sensitive person.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Ted Zeff. Ted Zeff, PhD, is the author of two books on the highly sensitive person, The Highly Sensitive Person's Survival Guide, and a workbook titled The Highly Sensitive Person's Companion. He's currently working on a third book, The Highly Sensitive Boy, Helping Your Son Become a Strong, Confident, Emotionally Healthy Man. Dr. Zeff received his doctorate in psychology in 1981 from the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, California. He currently teaches workshops on coping techniques for highly sensitive people. He's taught stress reduction and insomnia management for over 15 years at various hospitals and medical groups as well. Dr. Zeff has recently been giving many radio interviews throughout the United States and Canada at such stations as NPR affiliate KCLU in Santa Barbara, California, Cable Talk CRN with Jack Roberts in Los Angeles, WTMD in Baltimore, and WZLX in Boston. In addition, he's been interviewed on the popular TV show Good Morning Bay Area. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ted Zeff, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
Well, one of my listeners, Sean Davis, wrote me to say that you would make an excellent guest for the show. So thanks to Sean for the suggestion and to you for accepting.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so to get started, tell us a bit about your personal background and academic training.
I actually have a PhD in psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco.
Oh, yes, I know them.
Yeah, and I've been both a private therapist and teaching classes on highly sensitive people, as well as teaching classes on healing insomnia for Kaiser and Hill Physicians Medical Group.
Okay, and where does the idea of the highly sensitive person come from? Is that your own, or did you get that from somewhere else?
Elaine Aaron, who's an excellent research psychologist, coined the term highly sensitive person back in 1996. And what's interesting is when she first came up with the idea and she wrote the book, everyone said no one would be interested in buying a book about highly sensitive people. And subsequently, her first book has sold over 1 million copies worldwide, and it's a top bestseller. And it was a idea waiting to happen, because basically 20% of the population of the entire world has a finely tuned nervous system. And so you're looking at America, about 50 million Americans have it. And people with a finely tuned nervous system have trouble screening out stimuli, can be easily overwhelmed by noise, crowds, and time pressure. The highly sensitive person, or we call HSP, tends to be very sensitive to pain, the effect of caffeine, violent movies. highly sensitive people are made extremely uncomfortable by bright lights, strong smells, and changes in their lives. And this whole topic has taken off. I've written two books on the subject, The Highly Sensitive Person's Survival Guide and The Highly Sensitive Person's Companion. And I'd say about a third or more of the people who are purchasing my books and inquiring from my website are from countries all over the world other than the United States. So it's really a worldwide movement at this time.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, I'm curious about what drew you to this particular specialization. And, of course, I'm speculating that maybe you're a highly sensitive person. Is that what drew you to this?
You hit the nail on the head. When I read Elaine Aaron's book, I've been actually working my whole life on ways to deal with high sensitivity. My doctoral dissertation was about methods to reduce type A behavior. And I've been working on ways on stress reduction. And when I took the little test Elaine Aaron has to determine whether one is highly sensitive, I answered yes to every one of the questions, realizing that, in effect, that this is what I was. And the probably one of the most important things of this new terminology, highly sensitive person, is I get so many emails from people all over the world saying, I thought there was something wrong with me my whole life, and now I realize I just have a finely tuned nervous system. And I myself felt that when I finally realized that, wait a minute, I have a finely tuned nervous system, and I need to do things a little differently than other people. It's a neutral trait, but in this society that favors aggressive, pushing behavior, and kind of shames people for being sensitive or shy. Although 30% of HSPs are extroverts, it makes it very difficult for the highly sensitive person to feel like they're really fitting in with society. Like, for example, a highly sensitive person would tend to want to do quieter things at home rather than go out to loud concerts or movies on a Saturday night. It could be a challenge sometimes, but we have to learn, people who have the sensitive nervous system have to learn ways to compromise and adopt with an 80% society that's not highly sensitive.
Well, I was interested in your remark about I think you said 30% being extroverts, because you had written highly sensitive people have trouble screening out stimuli and can be easily overwhelmed by noise, crowds, and time pressure. They can be extremely uncomfortable by bright lights, strong smells, changes in their lives. And that made me wonder how much overlap there might be with Jung's concept of introverts, because in a lot of ways it sounds like introversion.
It's similar, but it's not identical, although Carl Jung himself was a highly sensitive person. And you'll see a lot of psychologists, a lot of people in the helping professions. Historically, the highly sensitive person was the priestly advisor in olden times. And the highly sensitive people are intuitive, have very good counseling skills, but you can't categorize they're all one way. As a matter of fact, you could be a highly sensitive person and only have two or three out of the, say, 20 factors of being highly sensitive, but if you have it very strongly, let's say crowds don't bother you, but loud noise drives you crazy, then you could still say you're a highly sensitive person. And there's also a thing called a high sensation seeker, so you could be a highly sensitive person and also be a high sensation seeker, which means you like exploration, traveling. And that's a little of a challenge, because people who are highly sensitive, they like the excitement of new adventures, but then they still need that downtime, that quiet away from stimuli.
That's interesting. Now, I'm sure some of my listeners are probably wondering if they fall into this category, because probably most of us can identify with one or two pieces of what you've said. How can someone tell if he or she is one?
Well, basically, if some of the major things, there's a little test you can take that's in my book, The Highly Sensitive Person Survival Guide. It's on the website in Elaine Aaron's book. But more importantly than that, you can just notice, are you the kind of person that noise bothers? Like, some people can hear, have a siren go by, and they don't even hear it, another person will jump out of their seat. So you're the person who tends to notice things like that. Do you have a really hard time with job pressure? Do you have a boss who stands over you and gets you more nervous, or someone who can just tune it out? Oh, it doesn't bother me if somebody, if a boss demands certain pressures on me. So people who are just more sensitive to people who don't like movies that are violent, you know, they have a hard time. I just am completing a book now about the highly sensitive male, and virtually all of the men said when they were growing up as boys, they'd avoid fighting, for example. And so you're seeing these characteristics of people who tend to be more advisors, artists, counselors, people in the helping profession. You're not going to see a lot of highly sensitive people in the Army or CEO of corporations.
Well, I personally can identify with a lot of what you've said, so I think I might fall into that category. You know, you mentioned sensitive nervous systems. I'm wondering, with all the new instrumentation that's available for studying the brain, et cetera, has there been any research on neural correlates of the sorts of things that you're speaking about?
Well, interestingly, Michael Gurian has written many books about boys' emotional health. He's talking about, it's just starting, it's new in terms of the research, but he's saying that, for example, if a mother during pregnancy had a lot of stress, it might have affected the testosterone levels, and he hypothesizes that maybe some people who have a sensitive, males with sensitive nervous system might have a lower testosterone level, but we don't know yet. It's mostly at this point we're seeing seeing it as a neurological, finely tuned nervous system. So it's a neurological trait that's a little different, where you just feel things deeper on every level.
Okay. Now,
and emotions too. Yeah.
Yeah, emotions too. Now, you sort of touched on this, but you might have more to say about the role that culture plays and how highly sensitive people feel about themselves and how they cope with the pressures of everyday life.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a study done, and they showed that the highly sensitive children in North America were the least liked and least respected. But the same study, they went to China, and they found highly sensitive children in China were the most popular and most respected. And what's interesting is, in the animal kingdom, for example, a horse that could sense danger is more sensitive to the environment and tuning in to the danger. The other horses will follow the lead, and that's probably why in tsunami there are virtually no animals killed, because the highly sensitive animal, it's also in the animal kingdom, you get in 20%, are the ones that sense danger and moved away, and people follow them. One man from Thailand I interviewed who was highly sensitive said that in his country he felt that he was more respected for being highly sensitive, and he was elected president of his class every year because the other students saw him as someone, it's almost like a shaman in historic terms, from
yes,
like Native American culture. So the certain cultures, and in India also, the people I interviewed from India, they said, well, people weren't, especially the boys, weren't abused or teased or laughed at for being sensitive. They're actually in some ways respected more because they were more in tune with subtle forces, being aware of dangers in the environment, subtleties. But yet in North America, especially in the United States, it's considered, especially in writing this book about males, is that for males to be highly sensitive, they're humiliated for it. You're supposed to be tough and like Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger and be strong, silent, crush people, as opposed to being sensitive. And then it's interesting, I was in Denmark working with some therapists with highly sensitive people last fall, And I interviewed many men from Denmark, and in Denmark, although it's somewhat similar to North America in some ways, the people in some northern European countries regard sensitivity in a higher esteem. So, for example, the highly sensitive men from Denmark might not have felt like they fit in as well, but nobody was really humiliated like they were in North America. So it really depends on the country you're living in terms of how people are going to grow up and perceive themselves and their self-esteem.
That's really fascinating that there are those cross-cultural differences. The difference between China and the U.S., that's not too surprising, you know, given what we know about these two cultures. And I think this is pretty closely related, and maybe we're talking about the U.S. here. What effect does being a highly sensitive person have on someone's social life, and what are some tips for maintaining a thriving but not overstimulating social life if you are a highly sensitive person?
Yeah, very good question. First of all, I just wanted to just go back to the thing, the cross-cultural part, which is interesting. And my theory is that the reason why it's different, let's say, in Europe as opposed to America, is the people who emigrated, who came to the United States, were the non-HSP adventurers. Wanted to fight the wilderness or fight the Native Americans. And some of the sensitive people stayed in Europe writing musical sonatas or making artistic masterpieces. And I think that's why historically the American culture is so individualistic and praise the individual and insensitive values.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. Makes sense.
Yeah, it seems that way. So to go back to your question about how do you deal with a society that's 80% non-HSP, so the key is going to be to compromise. Now, I always often say in my book that you don't want to become an insensitive-sensitive person, and it's important to learn how to compromise with the culture. But yet, so for example, if you're in a relationship with a non-HSP, and you're a highly sensitive person. So, for example, let's say your mate wants to go to a movie and to restaurants, and you like to just be more inward and do quiet things, so you compromise. You'll go to maybe a matinee or rent a DVD, or you can get food to go, or go at an early time when it's not so crowded. So you always have to learn how to compromise. Or let's say you have a partner who wants to go rock climbing. So you might go with the partner, but you can sit and read a book while they're climbing the rock.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just have to, you know, we just have, the key really is learning how to compromise. And actually, I was just working on this chapter about highly sensitive boys in sports. And I think it's important all children growing up, but especially the boys, because I'm working on the male highly sensitive now, to try and participate as much as they can with other boys in sports, because they would tend to just avoid any kind of interaction. So I think pushing yourself to the point where you feel safe and you feel comfortable, but not to be in situations where you're absolutely overwhelmed. So it's a fine line of setting your limits. We have some stimulation, but not getting overstimulated.
Now, are there certain problems that highly sensitive people are more likely to face in the workplace? And are there solutions that work at work?
Good question again about work. That's a big one, because almost all the people in my research a few years ago for my first book said that stress at the workplace was very challenging for them. And I have a whole chapter about how to thrive in your work situation. And it's important one thing I want to say, first of all, is that highly sensitive people make excellent employees. They tend to be very loyal, very conscientious, very responsible. They notice subtleties in the environment that other people wouldn't notice to make positive changes in the work environment. However, it's especially for some of these unfortunate people who have to share a large office. And I was just actually talking recently to a highly sensitive woman who works in one of these huge offices with these little cubicles, and you can hear all the noise from the other people. And it's very hard. So I would recommend for her to ask her boss, could she do some of the work at home? Could she come in earlier or stay later? Could she wear a headset to tune out the other noise? So you have to really be creative. Also, I had one situation of a highly sensitive person who had a office mate who is very loud, talking on the phone and playing music. And the first thing I said is you have to kind of get a rapport with the person. So you talk to the person about some neutral subject, and you tell the person, you don't blame them, but you say, I happen to have this finely tuned nervous system, and I wonder if we can compromise, if you can maybe play your music during the lunch hour when I'm gone, or talk on the phone louder at a different time. So you're always having to work in your work environment to create an environment that works for you. And if it can't work, I really recommend looking into other areas that are more copacetic for a highly sensitive person. So, for example, there was a man who was working, he's a financial planner now, but he was working for a large company, like a Wall Street type company, and it was just too stimulating. Now he has his own quiet office facing the San Francisco Bay, and he does most of his work by actually email, and he's just by himself in the office, and he's very relaxed. So you can, self-employment is an excellent option for highly sensitive people because you can control the external factors in your work situation.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as I'm sitting here in my home office and doing this work. And it works for me.
Yeah, it's very hard for highly sensitive people to be in a work environment that's very noisy, overstimulating, with rigid bosses who don't understand what it's like to be a highly sensitive person.
You know, that's probably one of the reasons why I ended up in academia, is I think I'm one of those people that doesn't like a boss staring over my shoulder all the time. And in the academic environment, there's quite a bit of personal freedom in terms of how you structure your time and when you're in the classroom. Unless you're being evaluated, you know, nobody's looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, it's very hard for sensitive people who have a tough boss who's always judging them. That they'll react so much deeper than a lot of other people who just kind of say, oh, whatever, and it doesn't bother them.
Of course, that makes it hard, too, being a teacher or being a therapist, are the concerns, you know, and again, I'm talking about myself, of the students judging me, the client judging me, am I doing a good enough job? That's been an issue for me.
Yeah, so kind of it's a mixed bag. It's, I'll say, like a highly sensitive person usually is a good student because they're so conscientious and responsible and creative, but yet then they'll agonize over their homework, for example. Am I doing is all the answers correct, and checking themselves. So yes, it's a mixed bag. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, well, speaking of a mixed bag, I mean, in some ways it's an affliction, but in other ways there's a positive side, isn't there?
I don't like to use the word affliction. It's more in terms of, again, we go back to the cultural differences. If you're living in a culture that's close to the earth where they glorify the shaman or the herbalist, it's considered a great attribute. Or even in a lot of these Asian countries, the sensitivity is much more respected, or Northern Europe. So a lot of it just depends on the society you're living in. But I wouldn't say it's an affliction. I would just say it's a neutral trait that's affected by how society perceives us. So it's so important that highly sensitive children get the support they need for their special talents, the special trait, so they can develop it. And really, for adults, to surround yourself with people who support your sensitivity. Be friends with other sensitive people. Don't try and compete with people who are non-highly sensitive and very aggressive and unemotional, because the sensitive person tends to be more emotional, sensitive to their environment, to other people. So it's so important that the highly sensitive people get the support they need and really not interact in a situation that's going to make them feel like there's something wrong with them and they're flawed just because they're not like the majority aggressive, overstimulating society.
What you're saying reminds me of some of the stuff that's coming out of positive psychology, in which they're saying the advice really coming out of positive psychology is to learn to recognize your strengths and focus on your strengths and develop your strengths.
Exactly. Yeah. And the problem is, of course, growing up, most people who are sensitive want to fit in, and so they'll repress their their innate abilities to fit in with the culture. So it's a question of fitting in, but also recognizing and appreciating all the positive qualities of being a highly sensitive person. And actually, I'd like to even mention some of them. I mentioned how sensitive people tend to be very conscientious and loyal. And when highly sensitive people aren't under stress, they can deeply appreciate beauty, art, and music more than most people. Sensitive people are intuitive and tend to have spiritual experiences. They notice danger. I actually make a joke sometimes saying, why don't highly sensitive people ever get Lyme disease? Because they'll notice the tick crawling on their skin before a non-HSP. And they know about safety issues. They're making the positive changes in the environment. All of those things about the noise control and stopping smoking and pollution are usually at the forefront of the highly sensitive people who don't like that. Very compassionate, kind, understanding. And I think the highly sensitive person, I just finished writing this little chapter and mentioning how when you look at all the spiritual giants from the Buddha, Christ, the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, they all had those wonderful same qualities in common as a highly sensitive person, about being compassionate, about really caring about the environment, having deep spiritual experiences. So it's a question of really putting the highly sensitive person within the right context.
Okay, you've mentioned cross-cultural differences. What about gender differences?
You know, it's interesting is when Elaine Aron did her research, she interviewed men and women, and she found that across the board it was 20% highly sensitive for males and females. However, the societal pressure for men not to cry, for example, was the one area she found. She found highly sensitive women said they cried more than the highly sensitive men. So you always have to take in effect the cultural bias about men. Basically, men have to repress their emotions except for anger. And one research study I recently read showed that infant boys are actually more emotionally reactive than infant girls. But by the time boys reach 4 or 5, they've learned to repress every emotion except for anger. Big boys don't cry. What are you, a sissy, showing your feelings? It's like, so a lot of it is the societal influence that makes even the difference between highly sensitive males and females a little different.
Yes, and I'm thinking about, I think it was Jed Diamond who I interviewed about men. You probably know his work. I'm forgetting what the term is. It's irritable male syndrome.
That's very good.
Yeah, it really is, and he's written a very compelling book. He's kind of oriented his work around that syndrome, just as you've oriented around highly sensitive person. And so he marshals a lot of evidence, really, that as men, we're quite sensitive. And what we really need from women to a large extent is soothing, that our emotional, that our nervous systems, in fact, are highly reactive. And that's why we tend to clam up when our woman gets on our case and so on. And often we, you know, either way overreact with anger or go into this sort of clamshell silence.
Yeah, well, that was accepted. But even little boys who are wild, if a kindergarten teacher hugs them when they come in, the boys enjoy it just as much as the little girls.
Sure.
But males are just taught from a young age never ever to show your emotion, although they have the same needs as females in terms of love and feeling connected.
Well, in fact, I believe you've recently been doing some research with males in. I think you did a survey of 30 sensitive men from 5 countries. What did you find?
As I previously mentioned, it in the men from Denmark, Thailand, and India had a much better time growing up as a sensitive male than those from North America. I found that, interestingly, the men who said they played sports in school had a higher self-esteem than the men who didn't play sports. And I think the reason for that is they felt like they fit in with the other boys growing up, and they didn't feel like they were flawed and they weren't sitting alone at home. The boys who had the most supportive parents were also had the higher self-esteem in North America. But even the boys who grew up, even the males who said they grew up in Asia or Europe, who didn't have such peer pressure or negativity even by the parents, still felt there was something wrong with them, and they were a little, they were flawed in some way because they were different. So, so this is why it's important to really extol the special qualities of sensitive people when they're growing up.
Yes. So I gather there are misunderstandings about sensitive men, and you've kind of alluded to that. Do you have any tips for parents or teachers in regard to dealing with sensitive boys in particular?
Yeah. It's so important that the parents treat the highly sensitive children, especially the boys, differently in terms of, let's say, discipline. A lot of parents will scream at their kids and, you know, really get upset. The sensitive child takes that in so deeply, and they want to please, and they're very conscientious and responsible, so a parent doesn't have to overreact. Yeah, with some boys who are highly sensitive, they might have to really come on strong for the kids to get it. But the sensitive people, sensitive children, usually don't have to come on so strong. It's really important that the teachers in school know that they have a child that's highly sensitive, because a lot of times a teacher will say, "Oh, the child's not learning." Well, they might be learning in a different way. They're checking out the environment. They have a little more difficulty dealing with being in a large classroom with all the stimulation. So teachers have to be aware of the sensitive child in terms of not expecting necessarily the same things that non-highly sensitive children do. They react slower. They pause to reflect more rather than jumping to the answer immediately. So if a child thinks about an answer and a teacher wants an answer right away, instead of condemning the child, understanding that certain children need more time because they tend to pause and reflect on the questions. I think it's important the parents have to really let the child know that the society, especially in North America, doesn't extol the virtues of sensitivity, but let the child know that they're special in a lot of ways, and really encourage them to develop their talents, may it be in art or reading or whatever it is, their gentleness. A lot of kids, even from an early age, find that they're good at counseling people. So the parents have to just really, really not... so many of these men told me, "Oh my God, my parents humiliated me. They said, 'What are you, big baby? What are you, spoiled?'" And really shamed the children who were highly sensitive. And that leaves a scar for life sometimes. And it can create post-traumatic stress disorder on children growing up, highly sensitive children who have had parents, peers, and teachers who've humiliated them. It could be really traumatic.
Yes. Now, on the positive side of the ledger, you say that highly sensitive people make better lovers. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. What's interesting is because the highly sensitive, let's say in this case, there were men I interviewed, they found they were better mates and a better catch than non-highly sensitive men because they were more emotional. They liked to work out issues with their spouse. They were more in tune with the needs of their spouse. So, so a lot of the men said, yeah, they felt they actually made better lovers because they weren't just focused on themselves, but they were focused on what would pleasure their lover. So, in effect, the fact that they are so more attuned to subtleties in the environment and concerned about other people makes them overall better, it could make them, I don't want to say it definitely makes them, but it could make a highly sensitive person a better marriage partner and a better lover.
Okay. Now, you not only write books, but you're also a psychotherapist. And I assume because of your high profile that you're probably treating a number of highly sensitive people in your practice. If so, how would you describe your overall treatment approach?
It's very individualized, because remember, one of the important things is that each highly sensitive person is different. And it just popped in my mind how I was shocked in my survey of highly sensitive men that 2 out of the 30 men said when they were growing up and even now they loved hunting. I said, huh? Hunting? And then one was, yeah, I loved using a BB gun and hunting with a bore rifle. Well, I don't even know what a bore rifle is, but he said he liked that. And I was sort of surprised, but these two men were raised more in a rural area. And even though most highly sensitive men are gentle, don't like violence, or concerned about the humane treatment of animals, it just goes to show you that each person is different.
Yes.
So the fact that I have this little subheading going, a paradox, the highly sensitive male hunter, you know?
Yeah.
So it goes to show you, so if anybody comes to me, I do actually phone consultations all over the country. Actually, I get people from other countries calling in for counseling, phone counseling, and each person is unique and different. And so one thing that's so important is because so many sensitive people growing up were told they were bad and wrong, it's easy to get a victim consciousness. And, I mean, I'll never forget this lady who called me, and she was so upset because she was living in New York City, and the people upstairs from her were making so much noise it was giving her a nervous breakdown, and she quit her job. I said, well, why don't you move? And she said, oh, I can't move. It's a rent-controlled building, and I like this neighborhood. So I see that kind of sometimes, that tendency to be a victim because they were told they were bad and flawed. And it's so important for me in my role as a counselor to really empower the highly sensitive person and try to get the neurons keep firing the same way. And it's like, oh, I'm not fitting in, I'm not good, and open up new pathways so they can see some of these beautiful characteristics of being a sensitive person and start getting a new way of being in the world. Because a lot of people who are highly sensitive, who have been abused as children, get really stuck in a very victim mentality, which doesn't work.
Yes. Now, what about diet and exercise? Do they play a role in the work that you do with these people?
Yeah, it's so important for highly sensitive people to do regular exercise. I'd almost say it's more important for highly sensitive people than non-highly sensitive people. Because highly sensitive people are going around all day absorbing energy. Some people say, one guy said, I feel like a sponge just absorbing everyone's negative energy. And so if they're exercising, it helps release any negative energy they've taken in from other people during the day. If you do regular exercises, the endorphins get released. You feel more joy, less stress. You'll feel healthier, stronger. That counteracts being a victim when you have a strong, healthy body. So it's so important for the highly sensitive person to do at least 20 minutes of aerobic exercise every day. I'm a firm believer that's actually, many studies have shown that people who did aerobic exercise got out of their depression just as much as people who were taking antidepressants.
Right. What about diet? Do you have any recommendations in that regard?
Yeah, it's because sensitive people might be more sensitive to the effects of, I mentioned earlier, caffeine, preservatives, like MSG in the food. It's really good to try and eat food that aren't sprayed with pesticides, organic fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and protein, and really stay away from a lot of the processed foods, because there's a tendency for some sensitive people to react deeper, and they tend to get physically ill sometimes just from eating a lot of the processed foods with a lot of the junk in it, to use a not-so scientific term.
Yeah, right.
But basically, red dye number 34 and all these preservatives and additives that sensitive people react to.
Yes.
In processed foods. So eating that organic fruits, vegetables, whole grain, especially in the winter, it's good for people with a sensitive nervous system to eat heavy, warm, moist foods. That's very grounding. So if sensitive people eat very light foods like sprouts and lettuce, like a big lettuce or sprout salad for lunch, they're not going to feel as grounded as if you had a casserole or lasagna or some heavy soups. So that's also important, yeah.
Interesting. Now, I noticed on your website, and also you mentioned this in your intro to this interview, that you also offer services to people suffering from insomnia. Does that tend to go along with being a HSP, or is this a separate specialty?
It is very, very related. I myself had insomnia for many years until I created this program that really works, and many sensitive people, because what we're looking at is people with a sensitive nervous system. And if you have a sensitive nervous system, there's a tendency that you're going to have sleep problems. Now, not all of them. I asked this question in my first book and this last one, but a large number, I would say maybe half of the people, have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. Well, if you get someone who can tune things out, who don't feel emotions deeply, who aren't overstimulated, they're not going to have the sleep problems. I remember Deepak Chopra once saying, I don't know if you're familiar with Ayurveda.
Yes.
Yeah, the healing science that comes from India. And Deepak Chopra, the famous holistic doctor from India, said he's a kapha type, which is someone who can tune things out. And he could have 3 cups of coffee before bed and fall right to sleep. If you're a vata, which is basically what a highly sensitive person is, someone with a very, very more nervous nature, if they have a cup of coffee in the morning, it could be enough to keep them awake at night.
Yes, my wife is an interesting paradoxical person who can drink coffee throughout the day and at night and then go to sleep. But that's very unusual.
It is, but she's definitely, I wouldn't say she's an Ayurveda, the vata type, the nervous thin type, or she wouldn't be most likely a highly sensitive person, because most highly sensitive people couldn't do that.
Yeah. So what's your approach for dealing with insomnia? You seem to mention that you've developed a special approach that works.
Yeah. In a nutshell, it's good to go to bed earlier. About an hour before you go to sleep, you turn off all the media. Actually, in the evening, it's best not to be on the internet.
Oh, yes.
Watching stimulating TV shows or DVDs. It's good to just do calming things like reading quiet, spiritually uplifting books. One thing that sounds very, not that important, but it's probably, when I teach the classes, one of the main things that helps get rid of insomnia: never, ever look at a clock after 8 or 9 p.m. because you need a hook. And what happens is people who look at the clock, oh, it's almost midnight, I got to hurry up and get to bed because I have to get up early. And it's just, you're setting yourself up. Oh, it's 2 in the morning, I haven't gotten to sleep yet. Oh, I woke up, it's 3 in the morning, oh my God. So if you're thinking of the time, then you're using your mind to hook yourself into getting more nervous and more anxious, and you're not going to fall asleep as long as the muscles are tense. So I have actually a wonderful CD on my website that is called the Highly Sensitive Person Healing CD, where I have a deep relaxation where I guide people into relaxing all the muscles in their body and doing deep abdominal breathing.
Sure. And I'll put a link to your website in the show notes so that people will be able to go there. And actually, why don't you just mention it right now?
Yeah, it's HSP, which stands for Highly Sensitive Person, HSPSurvival.com. HSPSurvival.
Okay. That's wonderful. Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
I guess I'd like to say that since 20% of the population has a finely tuned nervous system, that's millions and millions and millions of people all over the world. So it's so important to realize that the highly sensitive person is not alone, but they have millions and millions of brothers and sisters everywhere. There are chat lines for people. There's books to read. There's actually meetup groups now in a lot of cities. So I really encourage the highly sensitive person to get support. We have an HSP gathering twice a year in the United States. There's one in October in Colorado. There was one in the Bay Area in June. So, and in Europe they have these gatherings also. So there are other people out there to help you. There are counselors who specialize working with highly sensitive people. And please feel free to email me if you have any questions about being a highly sensitive person.
Okay, well, that's wonderful news for 20% of the people that are listening right now. Dr. Ted Zeff, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure, David.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Ted Zeff. Well, of course, this gets me to wondering whether I fall into the category of the highly sensitive person. I'm certainly willing to accept all the positive descriptors related to intelligence and creativity and so on. There are a couple of other things that make me think I might be a member of the club. My mother used to tell the story that I was such a sensitive baby that she had to put me in a closet to get me to sleep because I was so reactive to the outside stimuli of passing cars and perhaps light as well. Unfortunately, my mother is no longer around for me to probe her more closely on what might sound like borderline abusive behavior. I do know that I'm still very sensitive to both noise and light. I sleep at night with my head sandwiched between two pillows. Not only does this help to block out any outside stimulation, but I suspect it also provides a bit of a sense of protection and isolation, like a bear hibernating in his cave. I also find that I tire quickly in social gatherings these days and need to retreat to my own space. So even though I've never thought of myself before as a highly sensitive person, I'm thinking the moniker might fit. How about for you?
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. In your mind.
Well, here we are again after another 2 weeks. My voice is somewhat stronger than it's been. Hopefully it sounds more like my normal voice to you now. I'm on my fourth round of antibiotics, believe it or not, but still not feeling completely over this bug that's had me in its grip. However, the earthquake retrofit of our house that I mentioned last time has been completed, and I've totally reorganized our garage in the wake of that, as well as getting my office organized. I've even developed a standing alternative for working at my computer, which I'm using right now. I know that so much sitting at the computer over the years hasn't been good for my back. So I've come up with a solution that will allow me to alternate between sitting and standing as needed. My monitor is large enough that I can see it fine, looking down on it with it tilted up a bit from a standing position. And then I've got a portable shelf that I can put on top of my desk and throw a wireless keyboard and mouse on top of that without having to reposition my regular mouse and keyboard. Hey, I'm sufficiently excited about this setup that I've posted a photo of it for you, which you can find on the Shrink Wrap Radio site by going to the About Dr. Dave tab, selecting the My Podcasting Setup menu item, and then scrolling to the bottom of the page. And you'll see this picture that I took with my new iPhone. So all of this is to say the summer has not been a complete waste. I was a bit worried that going to an every other week format for Shrink Wrap Radio might jeopardize my standing on iTunes top 25 higher education shows. And indeed, that seems to have happened. Shrink Wrap Radio has dropped off the list. Our logo still shows up on that page, but it's further down now. I don't know if these are things that I really need to be concerned about or not, but certainly it will help if you do your best to promote the show and let all your friends and colleagues and so on know about it. Help get the word out there. That would be very helpful, as well as leaving any positive reviews that you might have on the iTunes site. Be sure to check out our Top Spots widget over on the right-hand side of the Shrink Wrap Radio page. If you haven't visited the site in a while, you should definitely take a look at it. This is a place where you can post an ad for your services or podcast or blog for a mere $20 PayPal payment, and that ad stays up for months and months. It's probably the cheapest advertising that you can find on the internet. So consider posting your own ad or patronizing one of our sponsors who've posted theirs. For example, the most recent one, which is in the top position, is from Al Tabor. I've mentioned it before. He's advertising his vacation rental in Inverness, California. And Inverness is a beautiful coastal, woodsy resort area that's very close to San Francisco. It's got lots of hiking trails and access to beaches. And it's an ideal vacation spot. So you'll find a link to that in the top widgets area, as well as a little ad further down the page, I think. And as you scroll on down further down the right-hand side of our site, you'll discover an ad for our newest sponsor, North of Eden. You recall my recent interview with Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster about their archetypal dream work approach? Well, they've come on board as sponsors for the next 3 months, and they're offering you a free 2-hour webinar on their approach. As a matter of fact, I'm planning to sit in on one this afternoon. I'm still curious to find out more about what they're up to, because I think they've got something unique going on there. And I encourage you to do so as well. If you do, be sure to let them know I sent you. If you haven't heard my latest Wise Counsel podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com, you'll find an interview there with Dr. Keith Sutton on oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Now, this should appeal to any of you who are interested in working with children. I want to thank all of you who've made either one-time or continuing donations. They help to defray some of the ongoing costs on this end, and also to enhance my motivation. Just look for the big green donate button on our website. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the various discount links on our site, for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Angie's List, and Avis Car Rentals. These can save you money and support this show at the same time.
Hi, this is David Gordon from Norfolk, Virginia, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Before we get into our listener email, there's a new limited-time GoDaddy discount offer that I want to tell you about. You already know that GoDaddy is the go-to place for web hosting. Well, from July 15th through August 31st, 2009, you can use my special discount code of SHRINK20H, and that's with a capital S and a capital H. So it's SHRNK20H with the S and the H capitalized. And what you get for using this is 20% off for either a 1-year, 2-year, or 3-year web hosting package. So once again, the discount code is SHRINK20H. So now let's catch up on some listener email. First, we hear from longtime listener Cody in Israel, who writes, "Hi, David. First, I'd like to wish you a happy belated birthday. I continue to enjoy your wonderful podcasts. I really enjoyed your interview with Tony Wolf also. At the same time, I also envied you because you had such a wonderful mentor as Tony. But you know, I'm still wondering what exactly Tony Wolf taught you about interview techniques." Well, it's been a long time since he taught me, so I don't remember the details, but he did teach me to take more charge of the interview process and not to be quite so passive and Rogerian. Continuing with her emails, she says, I think that you are born to be an interviewer. You have that alive hungriness to understand things better. You have the self-restraint not to interrupt, but to give the stage to the person you're hosting. You have that great honesty to really share your thoughts. You have all the great qualities that one needs to be a great interviewer. Cody, thanks so much for that. I really appreciate it, and every now and then a little reassurance is helpful. And she goes on to say, David, as far as I understood, you're going to, once again, doing a show on Lacanian psychology. I think in order to understand, to better understand that, one would have to understand better the whole thing about flow. Csikszentmihalyi isn't so great to explain flow. He knows what flow is, but he doesn't explain it so well. Cody, I'm not quite sure I see the connection between Lacan and flow, but at any rate, she keeps going. She says the best person I found to explain flow and use it in a good way is Summer McStravick. And she gives me a link to Summer McStravick's audio show on HayHouseRadio.com and suggests that she would be a great person to interview on a technique that she has that she calls flow dreaming. Cody says, which is a wonderful tool to get to things. I don't want at the moment to go into explanations. What do I think? What is the reason that it works? But it works. Maybe for you it sounds incredible that such a thing works, but believe me, it works. She says, that behind the flow dreaming she devised, there is a theory called flow thinking. And so she suggests that I consider Summer, and I'll kind of put her on my to-do list of things to consider. So thanks for that note, Cody. Next, we hear from Hunting, with whom I had some prior correspondence, which I think I might have read on air. He had inquired about how to deal with the arrogance which some people see in him. I think I had suggested that mindfulness meditation might be one path to become more aware of that. And here's part of his reply to my reply. He says, my arrogance comes into play because I'm very good at things that I do with passion, and I'm rather intelligent. While I have been studying for about 2 years Buddhism, meditation, and mindfulness, I'm not sure that I understand how to apply it in hopes of reducing/solving my arrogance, perhaps finding humility in the reality that I am so very small and relatively insignificant, regardless of whatever I accomplish, that everyone deserves respect and, quotes, loving kindness, yes, indeed. And for everything that I think I'm good at, there are at least 100 other people who are or were better. I could then be mindful of my words and actions to ensure that they are tempered with humility. Moving on, thank you so much for your offer to reach out to your audience in search of a book. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the information regarding switching. He was talking about switching into psychology, and I actually spoke to him on the phone and gave him some advice. He said it should prove to be very useful, particularly around volunteering. I suggested that doing some volunteering could pump up his transcript, so to speak. Thanks again, Dr. Dave. I'll definitely continue listening. Have a wonderful afternoon. And it's signed, Hunting. And so, Hunting, I think your own suggestions about how you would apply mindfulness, those make a lot of sense to me. But if I didn't do so before, let me again put out the request to the audience. If you know of a good book on dealing with one's own arrogance, please let us know. Next, we hear from Dr. Keith Sutton, who I mentioned earlier, I believe. He writes, I'm a big fan of your podcasts and wanted to see if I could make some suggestions for people for you to interview. You've had a few people that talked about family work, but I think these people might be good interviews about family therapy. That is the list that he's going to provide here. They deal with numerous issues, so you can also have them talk about a specific problem, as I know many interviews are focused on the problem rather than just the theory. And he goes on to list some names and give contact information. He mentions Jim Keim, LCSW, who's done a lot of work on oppositional defiant disorder and was a clinical director for Jay Haley, the creator of Strategic Family Therapy. He also suggests Salvador Mnuchin, one of the fathers of family therapy, Sue Johnson, creator of Emotionally Focused Couples Therapy, John Gottman and his wife, and David Epstein, co-developer of Narrative Therapy. Well, as I so often do, I turned the tables on Dr. Keith Sutton and suggested that he come on and be interviewed. And so his interview is currently up on Wise Counsel, dealing with oppositional defiant disorder in children. And I have tried to contact some of the people on his list, notably the Gottmans, who I think I need to try again, David Epstein, who turned me down. And but there's some good suggestions there for me to follow up on. So thanks for that, Keith. And I hope you're still listening and that you hear this. Next, we hear from Yasi, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've been a longtime listener, first-time writer. Every time I listen to one of your shows since 2005, wow, that's going back, usually while outside running or at the gym, I make myself a mental note to come back and write. And although a bit late, here I am. To make up for my tardiness, prior to sending you this email, I wrote a raving review on iTunes, recommended you on Twitter and Facebook, put myself on the Frapper map, and made a small donation on your site." Yay! Those are all wonderful things to do, and I thank you, thank you, thank you. She goes on to say, "I am a business strategy and organizational effectiveness consultant and coach. I've come this way through an 18-year engineering and high-tech marketing career. The world of personal growth and psychology was a hobby for a long time, until a few years ago when I chose to augment a one-year professional coaching training to my previous MBA education, after which I quit my corporate job and started my own consulting and coaching practice. I've been doing this for the last 5 years, and while I'm not at all claiming to be a psychologist, in my professional practice in helping corporations and other organizations, I tap into the works of many psychologists and other great thinkers and doers. Your show has been a great source of information and inspiration to me along my journey. I so very much enjoy your podcast and look forward to every episode. Your top-notch guests, added to your own knowledge, insight, and wonderful interviewing style, make Shrink Wrap Radio a very high-quality program. Thank you for a job superbly done. Warm regards, Yasi in Los Gatos, California." And Yasi, it was worth waiting for your email, I must say. And next we get we hear from Timu in Finland, who writes, "Hi Dave, greetings from Finland. I just completed the second episode of my podcast," spelled in a sort of Finnish type spelling, which looks like it says psychology podcast. And he says, "If you're interested," and he provides a link. However, the podcast is in Finnish. And he says, "Once again, thank you for your help with the technical stuff. This is done entirely with Skype, Wiretap Studio, and GarageBand. There was an article about this pod and me in the latest issue of Psychologist Union Newsletter, and I mentioned your podcast in the interview, so hopefully new listeners will find your podcast. The jingle is made by me, a MIDI keyboard and GarageBand." Well, I should tune in just to hear that jingle. He goes on to say, "Unfortunately, you probably won't understand anything of it because it's in Finnish. The first one is about the economic crisis from organizational psychology's perspective." Oh, that would be interesting. "And the second one, which will be online this week, is about web virtual bullying." That's a good topic, too. "These are pretty short compared to your stuff. The time is limited to 7 minutes. Wow, that is a short format. But then a lot of people probably would like a short format. And he signs it, "Best regards, Timu." And finally, we hear from Dione once again. She's written before, and she writes, "Hi, David. I hope all is well with you. This is Dione, your sole Lacanian fan. A few months ago, I was again listening to one of your interviews with Raul Moncayo and was struck by some of the statistics he threw out regarding the efficacy of antidepressants." By the way, Dione, I don't think you're the sole Lacanian fan. So anyway, back to where she says that she was struck by some of the statistics he threw out regarding the efficacy of antidepressants. At first, it felt to me like he was desecrating holy ground, which might be a consequence of what Peter Breggin refers to as medication spellbinding. But it made me want to read a bit about the criticisms by some psychiatrists toward the prescribing or over-prescribing of psychoactive drugs. I would have to say, however, that I felt a lot of resistance to do so, given the fact that in the last 17 years of my life, there's only been a six-month period when I wasn't taking at least one, and I've always assumed they were helping. I started with the book Let Them Eat Prozac by David Healy, and I'm currently finishing Peter Breggin's Medication Madness. I found the arguments reasonable, and with my doctor's consent, I began slowly tapering off one of the antidepressants I take. After going through some awful depressive symptoms, which in the past I've been told were a relapse of my pre-existing illness, and reaching a tiny non-therapeutic dose, my symptoms have slowly subsided, and I feel like I've had my life given back to me 100 times better than I felt while I was taking it. That's wonderful, Dione. This has been an incredible revelation to me, and I was wondering if you've ever thought about interviewing either David Healy or Peter Breggin, who's in the U.S., given all the discourse that simply takes for granted the helpfulness of psychoactive drugs. Why not interview someone who sees the issue from a different perspective? Let me know what you think. Best, Dione. Well, Dione, your story, of course, was marvelous, and it really stimulated me to contact Peter Breggin, and I did interview him, and I believe it's on the Wise Counsel series, so you'll find it there. And it was a marvelous interview. I was really impressed by what he has to say. He's a real champion, the Ralph Nader of psychiatry, as he's been referred to. And he was very gracious with his time and information, and clearly would be make himself available for future interviews if I wanted to focus it in a slightly different way. So I think that's the email for now. Let me remind you that you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voice messages using the My Chingo button on our site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. I don't get nearly enough voicemail. I would love to hear more of your voices. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Ted Zeff, for sharing his work on the highly sensitive person. My next show will feature Dr. Ann Weiser Cornell on the therapeutic technique known as focusing. Please stay tuned for one brief sponsor announcement. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Please help support Shrink Wrap Radio by shopping at brookstone.com and saving yourself 10% in the process with our special discount code of SHOWRAP. That's spelled SHOWRAP. Brookstone.com has a terrific range of unique products that are distinctive in design and quality. Brookstone.com is the place, and SHOWRAP is the discount code.